Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me all right? I'm sort of new to the technology here up front a little bit, but welcome to a guest lecture I'm giving to you today on islands in the Pacific and in the Maldives. And so this is a case study that sort of comes out of work I've done for World Vision as a research associate for the last 5 years. My journey started when I wrote for them a report called Planet Prepare, which sort of looks at a preparedness perspective with regard to humanitarian disasters and situations. So a lot of what I want to present to you today sort of comes out of my work, which I've done for World Vision as a research associate. And there's a lot of pictures, and I have video footage which I can show you, and a lot of material that I hope will be fairly light to digest and easy to absorb. And I hope we can have some more discussion in the tutorial, because the content I have here, we just will run out of time before I'm done with my presentation. So that's just how it's going to be. But nonetheless, I put a lot of the links and the videos, I embedded that in the slides. So once the presentation has been uploaded to Blackboard, perhaps you're interested to sort of look at some of this video footage, and because a picture just says so much more than facts and figures. So Planet Prepare is where my journey started. This is in Papua New Guinea. This is just by way of introduction. I was meeting some people who said that sea level on their island was rising. This is Chief John Keeler, who is standing on what he says was dry ground years ago, and basically just really concerned about sea level rise on his island in Papua New Guinea. Here's another chief from a different island I met in the write-up of this report. I actually met him in 2008, and then met him again in 2010, and so I actually gave him a copy of Planet Prepare, and he was rather pleased to see himself featured on page 5 of the report. And so there's a lot of people like these island chiefs I met who were telling me about climate change and what climate change looked like in their world. So it wasn't just sort of something you see on television, something that's perhaps distant and scientific. These were people, and that's where my journey began. This was in a coastal village near Leh, also in Papua New Guinea. This whole group of villagers had migrated inland about 2 kilometers because of rising sea levels. They'd been moving away from the encroaching sea for a number of years until they backed up against a back beach swamp, and they could back up no further, and so they were essentially forced to move inland. So this is one person, Albert Nye. He said, "The bush is better than the beach." So this is his new home, 2 kilometers inland from where he migrated to. This is Bangladesh. Bola, the biggest island in Bangladesh. I met a number of people who were just facing extraordinary erosion. You can sort of begin to grasp the extent of erosion on this particular island. And I visited with this man here, who was sort of a community leader, and he was sort of showing us around his village and explaining to us what was happening in the community. And it's actually interesting, I met him again last year, and I couldn't recognize the community anymore. It had just been so absolutely, totally been transformed by erosion. It was just a totally different place. And so he said here, this is in 2008, the place where I was born lies 5 kilometers out in the sea. I've already moved my home and family 4 times. Then he took us, this is just behind from where this picture was taken. He showed us around where there was an abandoned toilet pit. And he said, this family actually just left the day before you arrived here. And so this is in 2008. This is 2011. This is a different community, but the same island in Bangladesh. You can see the bridge. You can sort of see that there'd been a road, and that the road had sort of, the story was quite extraordinary after we met with these people and talked to them. And I wish I had time to show you footage from my videography I took, but I think the photo will say enough. basically the story was that a whole union had disappeared, due to erosion, and kilometers and square kilometers of land had been lost to the sea, and tens of thousands of people had been affected. So this is Bangladesh. Here again, very interesting, this is a friend of mine who was traveling with me in 2011, last year. He had himself a little BlackBerry, so we could actually see where we were standing because Google Earth just indicates with an accuracy to 3 meters where you happen to be, with the exception that where we were standing was actually here. We were standing right next to the sea, and so Google Earth was sort of, got it wrong because they're a number of years behind the kind of erosion that was going on. And so a lot of people obviously move into the cities. In Dhaka City, I did a lot of my research in Dhaka City and Chittagong and places like that, meeting with people who sort of end up in the slums. They leave, feel compelled to leave certain places, and then for lack of alternatives often find themselves forced to just find work in the slums. A lot of stories I could tell, but this is an overview of just Bangladesh again. You can see what sea level rise will mean in the country, in the most densely settled nation on earth. 1 meter sea level rise, 2 meters, 3 meters, 5 meters, it'll have a significant impact. And sea level rise obviously is something that I will be talking about to you today, hopefully fairly rapidly. This is a video that I, just because of time, I won't show, but it sort of makes the distinction between weather and climate. People always get the two mixed up in their minds. They look at weather and say, look how hot it is this summer. How can you disbelieve climate change? Then the next winter comes around. Remember in 2009 when the Copenhagen conference happened, it was extraordinarily cold. And so again, all the denialists were pointing to weather saying, look, where is climate change now? How can there be climate change if, it's 10 degrees below freezing? And so people always get it mixed up, and this is a little script we wrote. It was animated by UNSW students. So it's a great little intro to, the difference between climate and weather. And also that climate scientists need 25 years of data to establish climate trends. So you can't look at weather that changes from year to year, season to season. You need to measure temperatures for 25 years or more to establish a trend line. And so if you took different data points, perhaps here, and you took another one here, and you took a third one here, you could argue that temperatures are actually decreasing. And you see that being done on television by denialists and other people again and again and again. And it's important to know that you have to have these 25 years, and once you plot these data points on a 25-year timeline, it's as clear as a bell. There's no argument among climate scientists that temperatures are increasing, and which has an impact on a number of things, but sea level rise will probably be the thing that I'll be talking about most in this context of this case study on the Pacific Islands. One thing also to remember about global warming is that it can't sort of be reversed. It's sort of a one-way thing. I sometimes use the example, it's like a bank, but you can only sort of deposit money into the bank. You can't sort of take it out of the bank and sort of reverse the trend. Whatever emissions we put up there, they're sort of going to stay there. And that's a story that I want to tell in a few slides coming up. Here again, you can see the different ice ages. This is where Homo sapiens sort of showed up 200,000 years ago. And just where we are in terms of carbon dioxide emissions is just absolutely unprecedented in sort of human terms. Modern humanity just hasn't sort of ever been exposed to these kinds of levels of carbon dioxide emissions. And it's beginning to play out. This is another video. I think I'll just tell you the analogy. This is another script we wrote as a group, a meeting at the university. Again, it was animated by UNSW arts, fine arts students, I think. And so the analogy is, if you're driving a car and you're going at a speed of 100 kilometers an hour, once you hit the brakes, It's going to take you some time until that car comes to a complete standstill. Roughly, give or take, about 100 meters. That's roughly your stopping distance if you're traveling at 100 k's per hour. Now, taking that analogy and applying it to huge ocean liners, once that big tanker or container ship travels at full cruising speed, once the captain hits the brakes, that'll be traveling for miles and miles, and it'll be probably take about 20 minutes for that thing to begin to slow down and eventually stop. So you can't stop something very big very quickly. So if you apply this to the climate system, again, once we begin to stop emitting greenhouse gases and things that cause climate change, it will take decades. And a lot of people don't realize that there's a lot of warming, global warming, we're already committed to based on previous emissions. And so that's the analogy told by this little clip. This is a graph that is very important, and it's just a bit of scientific background. You can see the longevity of CO2. So let's say you're traveling today. I don't know if anyone came here by bus or you drove your own car perhaps. So there was some emissions here at year zero that were emitted, released into the atmosphere. And so right now there's 100% of those emissions up in the atmosphere. So let's look at how that decays over time. You go 30 years from now, and you can see 30 years from now there'll still roughly be 50% of your emissions from today still sort of hanging in the atmosphere and contributing to temperature rises. And 100 years from now, rather worryingly, there'll still be about a third. So you begin to see there's not a lot that you can do quickly. Whatever we try to do to adjust things, there will be a significant lag time, and of course this is assuming that there is a change in trends. So I was invited a few years ago to give a presentation on my work at a global relief forum workshop in Canada, where World Vision had a gathering of relief experts. And I just use an example from my flight traveling to Canada. I was lucky because the captain of that flight was open to discuss with me, you know, how much fuel, jet fuel, he'd put into his airplane, and also was open about how many people were actually, you know, with me on the plane that day. Usually captains sort of don't always disclose this sort of information, but he was a good sport. He sort of told me how it all added up. And so it was just a sort of a back of the envelope calculation for me to see, okay, if 1 ton of jet fuel burned causes 3.1 tons of CO2 emissions, we have so many people with us on the plane and on and on. I calculated that my own contribution, just per capita contribution, would be about 1.5 tons of CO2, not just for the whole plane load, just my share as being one of 100 plus people traveling to Canada that day. Now, of course, it gets more complicated. I'll leave out the radiative forcing index, which says that the high altitude emissions are actually worse than the one near the ground for all sorts of complicated reasons, so I'll skip that. But as good as it gets, roughly about 1.4 tons of CO2. And so you can see that in 2100, roughly 100 years, there'll still be a significant share of my emissions just, you know, to travel there and present to this group. And so in the year 3000, goodness, there's still some left there. So you begin to see it's sort of a one-way stream, and at whatever, you know, place we decide to stop putting new emissions out there, that's where, you know, temperatures will eventually begin to stop. So here's another little story I always like to tell. This is my grandma, Maria, here on the right, on the left. And she told me the story how this family, I'm from Germany, so how they came to own their first vehicle. So my grandma, being a very cunning sort of a woman, she's still alive in her mid-90s now, And she just stopped driving 2 years ago, so that's the sort of woman she is. She did a competition and signed up all family members into that competition, including the household nanny, who, long story short, ended up drawing the first prize and ended up winning herself a car, which was the first car that my grandma ever owned. And here it is. It was a Lloyd Alexander, which they'd driven for a number of years. And the reason I tell this story is because I talked to my grandma and asked her, look, how long have you had this car? Where did you sort of take it, blah, blah, blah. And just based on this graph I showed you, some of the information, there's still emissions from that car still with us in the atmosphere today, historical emissions. And so that's a very important point, because it's something that often comes up in our climate negotiations, especially when they stall. So that from this car, there's roughly about, give or take, 5 tons of CO2 still in the atmosphere. Now, the point of these figures is roughly right. Don't take it as precisely wrong. It's just sort of to make the point that these emissions don't quickly disappear. And so if you look at historical emissions overview by countries, you can see that the United States of America is roughly responsible for a third of the global greenhouse gas stock in the atmosphere. Now, the European Union, about a quarter. Together, these two blocks together have a share of about half of the global greenhouse gas stock, which is always a sticking point when these countries meet to negotiate a way forward, because there's all this climate liability. You know, we're still sort of dragging with us, which makes negotiations difficult moving forward. So the 10 biggest emitters together, you can see, are roughly responsible for a huge part of the global greenhouse gas stock, which is what small island states today are pointing to. Say, look, we're beginning to go under, sea level is rising, someone's going to have to pay for our relocation process, and we don't think, you know, that we're really to blame for what happened. You guys should really help us. And so this is, again, something that comes up in negotiations again and again. And it's important to know where that comes from. Now, based on this climate system inertia, you can see that there's temperatures have risen by about 0.8 degrees Celsius since industrialization began. But there's roughly another 0.5 degrees Celsius in the pipeline already that we can't prevent. We're roughly committed to warming of about 1.5 degrees Celsius already, which you will see being borne out in your lifetime. So don't think climate change is going to go away. I think we're just sort of getting started. You'll see a lot more climate change sort of impacts registering in the world as we all grow older. Hopefully technology will help us to create innovative ways to maybe draw down CO2 from the atmosphere. Right now, that's in its infancy. I'm not sure that will be a mature way to think about reducing impacts anytime soon. So here is a conference, and again, I put this in here if you want to look at what the experts are saying, where we're headed. You can look at a lot of slides and presentation and download audio. This is a conference that happened in Melbourne last year. And the scientists are beginning to think at what will life be like at roughly maybe 4 degrees or more. Because remember, Copenhagen ended without a binding commitment. So the scientists calculated, look, if every country voluntarily abides by what it says it wants to do without any binding mechanism to enforce this, temperatures will roughly shoot to about maybe 3, possibly 4 degrees or more. So they named this conference after this finding, 4 degrees or more, and it's quite a terrifying thing once you dig deeper and look at what it will imply for the Great Barrier Reef. What it will imply for the Amazon rainforest, what it will imply, and you just go through the list, what will 4 degrees Celsius of warming by 2100 imply on the ground in all these different categories that scientists were presenting. So this is a great resource to really be caught up to the state of the art of the science and what it'll imply in the real world. This is, again, you can see the different scenarios why they think it'll be about 4 degrees. Roughly, these are all the measurements here. And it's just a trend that you can't sort of change quickly. This is roughly where we are. And so under the best of circumstances, we could maybe bend down the curve and try and push it to below or two degrees Celsius of warming. Not a lot of faith in that. That was a sense I got from that workshop. So what does this mean in terms of impacts in the real world? Sea level rise. Sea level rise happens for two reasons. One, the warming of the water causes the water to expand. So water will push up. It's called thermal expansion. And right now, sea level rise is roughly produced by thermal expansion by about 40% of sea level rise that's being measured. The other aspect is land-based melting ice, which is responsible for about 60% of sea level rise. And perhaps you've heard it on the news. In the last several days, there's extraordinary melting again in the Arctic happening, and a new record was just again reached. This is actually outdated. I should have updated the slides. This was, you know, records in 2007, 8, and 9. Now, 2012, there's a new record, and melting in the Arctic will happen till about September, middle of September. So right now, it's a reason for concern. I'll just skip these, I think, but these are again useful. This is just for a few days old. I mean, just so you don't think this is from years ago. This has been in the news just a few days ago, and you can get a sense of the kind of warming that happens in the Arctic. Now, people say, well, the Arctic, don't worry too much because it's the ice is floating ice, so it's sea level neutral. But there's, of course, a Greenland right there in that vicinity, which if Greenland melted, it would raise sea level by about 7 meters altogether, roughly, give or take. That's how much ice is locked away in this big ice sheet. So I'll just skip these. This is the Antarctic. And again, there's a lot of sea level rise potential being locked away there. And that continent will again begin to discharge ice once we go into the southern hemisphere summer. Melting in the northern hemisphere will slow down and stop. In the southern hemisphere, it will begin to get going. So sea level rise by projections by about 2100 is roughly 1 to 2 meters is what the scientists are saying. But the trend line here from satellite observations is sort of at the upper end of what was thought likely a few years ago. And then often the reference data is 2100. Don't forget, it's a good working hypothesis to assume that humans will be around well beyond 2100, and you can see sea level rise just won't stop. It'll the process of warming of the ocean is so slow, and it takes so long to sort of work itself out that a few hundred years from now there could be significant sea level rise happening, which has implications for not just small island states, which is what I'm talking about, but also coastal megacities. Here is a schematic representation of a small island. So you have the different features here. The sea level sort of at the normal level. You have a well here, and it's feeding fresh water up from the freshwater lens. Beneath, you have the brackish water, and there's agricultural land. and now you have sea level rise imposed on that island. What does that look like? Sea level rises, so there's coastal erosion, higher sea level, and the increased wave energy. Often there's population density increases on a lot of these islands, and so there's more and more people finding themselves living together on potentially less and less available land. And it's a feature that you already find on a lot of small island states. Loss of agricultural land from groundwater and soil salinization. And here, very importantly, the well is now no longer drawing fresh water, but it's with the brackish water pushing up from beneath, the well water is beginning to be salty. And this is something that I already observed in Papua New Guinea on a number of these islands, where they told me that the well water tastes very salty. Islanders now use it only for cooking and bathing. A number of different wells. I didn't drink from this particular well last year, but they gave me some to, you want to taste? And I said, sure. And sure enough, I could taste the salt water. So what's the research problem? It is, in the simplest of terms, a number of studies have said that our results reveal that hundreds of millions of people in the developing world are likely to be displaced by sea level rise within this century. Here, this is John Schellnhuber, a very eminent scientist who also advises the German government. He says, when we talk about a 1 meter rise in global sea level, we're also talking about 500 million people who are going to have to look for new homes. So far, we don't have any instruments to manage this. I was talking to him a few years ago at his office in Potsdam, and he said one of the things that we will need to ask these people is where they want to go to. If they're being displaced, someone needs to go and find out from them where they want to relocate to. I thought that's an interesting thing to ask them. So it's one of my research questions I'm asking people as I do my field work. If it comes to relocation, and in many places it's already happening today, where would you like to go to in an ideal world? Because there's all these liability questions, and we should never just assume that everybody will want to necessarily come to Western countries. In fact, what I found is that a lot of the people, they're very happy where they're living. They'd much rather stay where they are, and their hope isn't necessarily to come to Australia or to go to Europe or America, although there are always a few of them who also mention that. The majority seem to want to stay right in their countries. I found that a very interesting sort of finding from my work. Another study, if emissions follow a business as usual scenario, sea level rise of at least 2 meters is likely this century, hundreds of millions of people would become refugees. So this is a pilot study. This is again on the Toulon Atoll in Papua New Guinea in the Pacific. And basically, this is one of the atolls where I spent a few days. And I think I'll show you one short clip just to introduce the issue and then skip a few other short videos. And this is also another atoll where I spent a few days. And this is the place where they're relocating to. So it was quite interesting to go and see some of this material in the origin community on the atoll, and then also in the destination community where they're relocating to, and asking people about the whole process. And it's a sort of a live situation that's unfolding, quite fascinating. And there's a lot I could share, and maybe we'll talk more about that in the tutorial. So this is a short clip. I think we have time for a few minutes just to watch that. And this is actually the atoll right next to the one that I just showed you.
Of course, I believe. This is all these people, their whole culture, their life, everything is here.
God has spoke to me through a dream. I saw that sea coming into the island and destroying all the garden.
This one too is getting yellow sea. A sign of dying.
The question is, why can't we give a young
the diamond?
doesn't do anything.
I came here to tell you people that we have to leave what we have and move out from this island.
I don't think the consequence can work if we take it out to others.
So that's from an award-winning feature documentary. Again, the documentary was filmed on the Ta'u Islands. So it's very similar to the actual atoll I went to, which is the Tulun Atoll there. So just moving on to a small discussion. There's the question, well, can't you build seawalls? Isn't that what's the most straightforward thing to do? Well, I mean, I've seen a lot of seawall attempts. This is on the island of Buka, where you can see these so-called gabion baskets, which they fill with rocks, and they're trying it on the atoll. This is the Tulun Atoll, but you can see when the ocean comes, it's basically an adaptation measure that they've tried, and they've work with that for years, but it hasn't really worked. These are interesting videos. It's because of time, I won't take time to show them. This is on the Tulun Atoll itself, United Nations University, little documentary, 6.5 minutes from that same place that I visited for my pilot study. And this, I think, is Kiribati and Tuvalu, the president's dilemma. Also very interesting clips that you may want to follow up on. Again, on the Tulun Atoll, you can see remnants of what sea level rise looks like. This is a coconut tree, and we're going around the island in the boat, and there's a coconut tree sticking out of the water from in front of us, so you can sort of see where there used to be land a few years ago, and now it's just been shrinking so much. This is another very important thing. People don't realize often that sea level rise is not happening uniform around the world. People think, well, why is this place experiencing more sea level rise in a more dramatic way than this place over there? And this is from Professor John Schellnhuber again, who talked about the injustice of sea level rise in his talk at the Melbourne conference, 4 degrees or more, which I showed you the link to before. And this is just a quote I typed up from his talk that he was giving. And he was saying, because of the gravitational issues and the gravitational pull for seawater around Greenland, sea level may actually drop, but sea level rise will be more pronounced in places like the Pacific. So again, islands that have contributed least to the problem of sea level rise are being hit harder than countries around Northern America or Northern Europe that carry a significant share of the responsibility. It's a long quote which you can read in your own time. Just beginning to wrap up, this is Male on the Maldives. I visited that island twice. And first was in 2009. It takes about an hour to walk around the perimeter of the island. And the Maldives have been very effective, being very well resourced financially, to build very heavy sea walls around some of the major islands that they've developed with infrastructure. But most famously, perhaps, the former president of the country, President Mohamed Nasheed, was quoted again and again in the media saying, "We do not want to leave the Maldives, but we also do not want to be climate refugees living in tents for decades." So apparently there have been some discussions to purchase land elsewhere if it were ever to come to a scenario where the people would have to leave the land. This is from a first visit. See some erosion, but this is probably, if I have just a couple minutes, I'll show you just a little bit of footage from my second visit to Maldives last year. And let me see if I can find this. This is Maldives 4. This is slow. There's too much footage on here. Maldives 4. Just show you a few seconds and talk over it. And my hope is to produce a documentary from a lot of the footage, but I need time to do that, and time, as always, is in short supply. So this is one island, the island of Hatifushi, where they've had a tsunami and they've also had a storm surge. And so based on those two experiences, the islanders decided to abandon the island. So if you go and visit the island of Hatifushi, this is what you see, basically just reminders of the kind of life that had gone on that island before it was completely abandoned. And our skipper who took us there, he showed us also his house, and he's pointing to how high the storm surge reached, basically flooded the whole island. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, if you like. Afterwards, the islanders said, "Look, we don't have a future on this island. We need to go somewhere else." And so, again, it's often in these extreme events, the storm surges, that people will be hardest hit. It's perhaps less the gradual sea level rise, but it's the storm surges superimposed on the gradual sea level rise, which is most hard for people to adjust to, and oftentimes impossible. And so just in perhaps one final point I can make, this is Maldives 6. And I told you that Maldives is very good with regard to land reclamation, has the resources to build seawalls. And just from a lot of footage that I could be showing, I just show you how we're taking off. There's my wife. It's unedited, like I said. But here we are taking off from Male. And this is a great overview of some of the land that was reclaimed by the country. And you can see it in a few seconds as we're just sort of leaving. So basically all this land that you see coming up here, this is all artificial. It's an artificial island. Basically it was reclaimed, and you can see the infrastructure that's there on the island. We visited there a couple times. A lot of houses, and so it's sort of seen as the overflow island from Male, which was very crowded. You could see that in the slide I showed you before. But the hope is to extend the island and perhaps make it even bigger, and to extend right out to the reef here and include this other small island, and really continue to sort of grow. So I was very impressed with how the Maldives manages its environment. and was wondering whether they would, at the end of the day, would be displaced necessarily at all, if they're going to be able to just keep building up, 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 just pouring more and more concrete. It'll completely transform the island, and the question is whether the country will be resourced in the same way if tourists don't sort of find the sand and the beauty and what Maldives is famous for, and instead find these massive infrastructural bulwarks to protect themselves from the sea. So I guess these are sort of the main slides I wanted to show you. I could show you a few more. This is a minister again. Don't have time to discuss. Basically, what we're faced with going into conclusions, we really need to decarbonize our global economy, going from a fossil fuel-based economy to one that is basically based on renewable energies. And we need to do that within the short space of a few years / decades. It's an extraordinary challenge, really, that humanity is facing at this time. This is a great report on how to perhaps bring about such a great transformation, which is sort of almost a revolution of sorts. So two things, just in wrapping up, there's adaptation that needs to happen, where you adapt to things like climate change impacts that you cannot prevent. And there's mitigation, trying to reduce the impact by changing our energy regime, if you like. And again, this is from a conference, more material on how you might adapt in different ways. I think that's probably all I want to take time for. I don't know if there are a couple of questions, perhaps. I do want to acknowledge World Vision. That's been a faithful organization and has sort of accompanied my journey of research and been very supportive in logistics and all sorts of ways through their programming presence on the ground. But are there any questions, perhaps one or two questions, just from anybody? I know we'll have time to talk more about this in the tutorials I teach next week. But from any of you who are not in my tutorial, any questions or comments? Angus?
I think I remember a few years ago something in a news report or something about artificial coral reefs floating that rise with sea level as a form of infrastructure. Is that in practice or is it faulty?
Yeah, again, they have interesting studies or projects going on in Maldives, actually, just on that point, to see how can you grow coral artificially and help the coral formation process, maybe speed that up, to use these natural protective systems to protect against sea level rise. And there's some promise in these projects. The question is whether the sea, as it grows increasingly more acidic, with the carbon dioxide being absorbed by the water, the growing conditions for coral formation are basically turned upside down. And so the question is whether this transformation, changing from a fossil fuel-based economy to a non-fossil fuel-based one, can happen quickly enough to allow the ocean to still have growing conditions in which coral formation can work at all. But it's being trialed. The what island? Ta'u, the one in the video. They're near Papua New Guinea, or actually it's Bougainville. It's an autonomous part of Bougainville, long story. It's very hard to get to. We had to, just shoot out into the ocean for hours in a small little, what's called a banana boat. And it is quite a freaky experience because you're just looking at blue water. There's not a speck of land anywhere, and the land behind you is disappearing the further you travel out, and there's no land. And sometimes these skippers overshoot, this tiny speck of land that you're trying to hit without GPS sometimes, and they just shoot right past it, it happens, and then it drift for weeks, and eventually they catch it. But it didn't happen to us. We actually reached there safely, and here to tell the tale. Thank you very much for your attention. This is all we have time for. If you do have questions, please email me, and have a good day.